Hello and welcome to Media Geek. This is your weekly look at the world of grassroots and independent media, as well as a critical examination of our media environment. My name is Paul Rees-Mandel and I'm your host. On today's program, what will be the big public interest issues for media and telecommunications in 2006? And an unembedded reporter in Iraq. We'll hear from Mark Cooper, Research Director at the Consumer Federation of America, who will tell us what to look out for when Congress rewrites the Telecommunications Act next year. And we'll listen to an encore of an interview with reporter Aaron Glantz, who reported for Pacifica Radio from Iraq after the fall of Saddam. Do stay tuned. On Monday, October 31st, the FCC unanimously approved the mergers of SBC with AT&T and Verizon with MCI, making the nation's two largest telecommunications companies even larger. Public interest and consumer groups are worried that the merger is a big step backwards towards having regional Bell monopolies again. The Justice Department approved the mergers the previous week with barely any conditions. The FCC, however, placed a few more restrictions intended to help protect consumers and small businesses. However, the road to pass the mergers was not an easy one for the FCC's commissioners, especially not Republican Chair Kevin Martin, who wanted to take the same path as the Justice Department and approve the mergers with no conditions. But right now, Martin is not enjoying the typical Republican majority on the commission that he would normally have under a Republican president. That's because the Bush administration owes the appointment of two commissioners, one to replace former Chair Michael Powell, who stepped down last spring, and one to replace Commissioner Kathleen Abernathy, who is staying on until her replacement is named. Because the FCC currently has two Republicans to two Democrats, Martin was forced to compromise some with the commission's Democrats and include a few minor provisions on the SBC and Verizon mergers. But it didn't happen without a fight. The FCC was originally supposed to vote on the mergers on Friday, October 28th, but the meeting kept getting delayed throughout the day as commissioners were stuck in negotiations over the merger's conditions. Eventually, the commission called it a day and rescheduled for the following Monday, the 31st, where the mergers were approved with a few of the Democrats' conditions. Amongst the public interest provisions included in the merger are a 30-month freeze on wholesale prices on high-capacity lines charged to competitors, and the effective unbundling of phone service in DSL, where within 1 year of the merger completions, Verizon and SBC will have to provide DSL service to customers without also requiring the purchase of basic telephone service. The FCC's Democrats also got the inclusion of a limited network neutrality provision. Network neutrality requires that SBC and Verizon be prohibited from discriminating against competitors and allowing access to their network infrastructure. It also applies to content, where the companies may not block customers' access to it, like audio or video, that is provided over the internet by a competitor. However, the network neutrality condition is only in effect for 30 months after the completion of the merger. Overall, groups like Consumers Union and the Consumer Federation of America have called the FCC's conditions a mixed bag for the public interest, since most conditions on the deal expire in less than 3 years. The SBC, AT&T, and Verizon MCI mergers highlight issues that are currently being negotiated in the hallways of Congress, between industry lobbyists, public interest advocates, state and local governments, and lawmakers. That's because Congress is already working on a major rewrite of the nation's broadcast and telecommunications laws that will take the form of the Telecommunications Act of 2006. The last rewrite happened in 1996, and by many accounts, lawmakers and the public were in the dark about a good deal of the 96 Telecom Act's provisions and the effects the Act would have on our telecommunications and media landscapes. For instance, it was the 96 Act that lifted the national limit on radio station ownership and greatly increased the limits on local radio ownership, setting off a rapid consolidation of the industry and the creation of broadcast giants like Clear Channel and Infinity. A Clear Channel empire of over 1,200 radio stations could not exist before 1996. Issues like media ownership will be on the table for the forthcoming Telecommunications Act of 2006, but so will many issues that directly address the prominence of internet and broadband technologies in telecommunications and media. Network neutrality is just one concern that public interest groups will be asking Congress to address, while the telecom industry will be fighting it tooth and nail. At the National Conference for Media Reform this past May, there was a session dedicated to understanding the forthcoming Telecommunications Act rewrite. Mark Cooper, Director of Research at the Consumer Federation of America, gave a very clear overview of the matters he thinks will be most important for the public to be aware of and make its voice heard on.
I really do believe that they have lost control of the means of production of information in our society, which is why they're applying so much force. And so what we must do is preserve that free speech and fair use. That's my tagline. I'm sure the focus groups will take a hold of it and figure out it needs to be done differently. But that's my slogan. And so we also want to do more than simply preserve what we used to have, because this is the digital future. We want to make sure that the digital future lets us get more stuff. And I'll give you one little example. This seemed to work the other day. There was a picture a few weeks ago, and John Stewart used it numerous times, of President Bush holding hands with Sheikh Abdullah. And it was a really bad picture for people who manage sound bites or sight bites. You know, it was odd how they let that one get out. That picture was grabbed by all kinds of people and circulated on the web. If the broadcasters have their way, you won't be able to do that. You won't be able to do that. The broadcasters wanted to take the record button off the VCR 20 years ago. They lost that case 5-4 in the Supreme Court. It's amazing how close it was. After two oral arguments, that's all that kept the record button on the VCR. A few years ago, they sued another distribution network because there was a peer-to-peer network, and they went into the bankruptcy because there was a record button. So we need to make sure that, and this is the simplest way I can say it, we get to have those record and playback buttons. They'll confuse you with the most immense technological gobbledygook, but it comes down to a simple issue. I want my record button. I want my playback button. And it's peer-to-peer networks, it's VCRs, it's broadcast flag. What the heck is a flag? The simple answer is that I want that functionality. There will be language in the Communications Act of 2006 that deals with this issue. We'll have a bigger issue on copyright and peer-to-peer. Same principle. We want to be able to share stuff the way we always have. Second principle that will come up, and it flows off of the digital transition that I mentioned. Remember, we gave the broadcasters the spectrum to give us digital TV. They couldn't figure out how to make money with it, right? Selling people pretty pictures doesn't let them charge more for their advertisements, right? So they didn't use it, and since they got it for free, they sat on it, you see? And that's a perfect sound economic principle. If somebody doesn't pay for it, they won't use it until they can figure out how to make money. Well, now they've been sitting on it for 10 years. Almost nobody in this room has a digital television. Why? Because there's not much to watch and it's not really worth watching anyway. People want that spectrum back. They want the old stuff back for a variety of reasons. And as I said this morning, Congress needs money, so they want to sell your free speech rights to buy bonds. That's what they're doing here. They're selling the right to use the airwaves to fill the deficit. We thought it was silly to give this stuff away. Selling it for these purposes is even worse. The one thing we can really ask for are two things. One thing we can ask for is the right to use it in our Wi-Fi mode, our sharing mode. We want to be able, right now those Wi-Fi networks are compacted, compressed into a small space in this vast airwaves that used to be called the junk bands. Nobody wanted to use them, so they said, hey, let's let these people use it. The only thing down there are microwave ovens, you will have noticed when you walk by your microwave oven. And lo and behold, when they let the people have the airwaves, they have done a magnificent thing, created an open space to speak. The same principles of sharing that apply in the junk bands can apply to lots of other space in the spectrum that isn't junk and will make our lives a lot easier to build those networks. So we want the right to share in a non-interfering fashion the rest of the spectrum. We can get that. We can get that if we speak loudly enough. Another issue that will definitely come up is this: is the question of when we gave the broadcasters the digital spectrum, they went from one channel to six channels. They will be able to fill up six channels worth of stuff. Now, some of us don't think they ever should have one, but the fact that they want to have six is an outrage. The fact that some will have 12 because they own two of the originals. Now, there maybe we should take back from any, once they went from two to six, why should they go from two to 12? We should also ask for, maybe one of the six ought to be dedicated for something else. Public TV, maybe to be used as a communications network. We can ask for that stuff. Because asking for that doesn't lower the price they're going to get for selling the other stuff. So we can ask for these things in order to balance out the giveaway of the spectrum. We really wish that we didn't give any of it away. We shouldn't sell any of it, but at least maybe we can get some really good uses. Because in my world, if the people get to speak in those other places, eventually our voices will overwhelm them. Once we let people speak, they know what to say. One other set of issues that may or may not come up, depending on how the court cases go, is this question of what Russ mentioned it, network neutrality. This was my Paul Revere example, right? And we have two ways we can ask for that in this legislative round. One, at least since the original roads were built, and then when the railroads and the telephone companies tried not to do it, we have forced them to allow anyone to use these networks on a non-discriminatory basis. They've been called common carriers. We can call them what we want. They have to allow people to use the communications network on a non-discriminatory basis. This is a principle that is almost 500 years old in our capitalist tradition. And we can ask for that, and we can get that. The final thing we can ask for, and we believe there will be legislation introduced, is this question of community wireless. And when the reporters called up, we were fighting in Pennsylvania over legislation, and they said they would ask the question, why shouldn't the cable operators and telephone companies be the one to build the networks? And my initial answer was, well, to begin with, they're doing a crummy job. But that's not the right way to approach it. The question is, why shouldn't the cities build the streets? We don't say that General Motors should be the one responsible for building streets, because we know where they'll build them, to rich people's houses, and the rest of us will be stuck in the mud. So the real answer is here, that cities have always been responsible, or state governments, for building the roads for communications and commerce. Well, this is the information age. Al Gore invented the internet, and we ought to allow cities to build the on-ramps to the information superhighway. We can at least get the federal Congress to adopt a law that says states can't prevent cities from doing so. So there were, I think, five or six specific things rendered in, I hope, simple English. Because remember, they will start to confuse you with legalese and technology ease. Simple principles, free speech, fair use, I want my recording button, and I want an on-ramp to the information superhighway that lets me use it in a fashion that serves my interests. Thank you.
That was Mark Cooper, Director of Research at the Consumer Federation of America, talking about the issues to look out for as Congress begins drafting the Telecommunications Act of 2006. That was Mark Cooper, Director of Research at the Consumer Federation of America, talking about the issues to look out for as Congress begins drafting the Telecommunications Act of 2006. That talk was recorded at the National Conference for Media Reform, held in May of this year. Reporter Aaron Glantz was on the ground in Iraq, unembedded and independent, on his own, right after the fall of Saddam, after the American invasion of that country, and was there during the occupation. But he's back in the States now, and he's written a book about his experiences and what he believes is really going on in Iraq for regular Iraqis, for regular people. That book is called How America Lost Iraq, and I was able to sit down with him for an interview where he tells us more about the book and his experiences.
I went to Iraq as a reporter for Pacifica Radio for Free Speech Radio News, and when I first got there, I was very surprised to find that most people in Iraq were very happy that Saddam Hussein was gone, and they were not necessarily angry about the invasion. But spending time there over the next year or so, I found three key things, actually four, that really alienated the vast majority of people to the occupation and caused people to pick up the gun and shoot at American soldiers. And those are the lack of basic services like electricity and clean drinking water, the attack on Muqtada Sadr, the Shiite cleric, the Abu Ghraib prison scandal, and the bombing of Fallujah. And after these four things, at about April or May 2004, the atmosphere in Iraq had completely changed. People wanted America out right away, and they were supporting people shooting at American troops. And I came back to this country at the end of May 2004, and I found that most people had no idea what it was like to be in Iraq and didn't really understand what was going on, and that's why I decided to write a book.
And what was it like being an independent reporter in Iraq, especially an American independent reporter?
I got my start in journalism at KPFA at the flagship station of Pacifica, and I got involved in journalism because I cared about whether or not I could afford an apartment in San Francisco, the city that I grew up in, whether public transportation would be functional, whether the parks would be clean and places where people could take their children. And I saw no reason why I couldn't do the same kind of reporting in Iraq. These are the important issues no matter where you go, and I really resented the politicization of the story. Everyone wanted to know, well, what about this faction and what they want and this faction, you know, blah, blah. And I said, well, wait a second here. Let's get back to the basics. So I got in a taxi cab in Amman, Jordan, 2 weeks after the fall of Saddam Hussein with a French colleague, and we just headed in. We rented an apartment, and we stayed there, and going around, you know, in regular running taxi cabs and cars, giving people the respect that they deserve as people, you'd be surprised at how much respect that you get back and interest, and people have stories to tell. You know, you go around without an armed entourage, the way most of these corporate journalists do, and people stop to see you as somebody who's interested in listening to their story. People approach you a lot differently if you just show up. You say, I'm interested in listening to what you have to say.
Well, something I learned from Naomi Klein's talk at this spring's Media Consolidation Conference here at the University of Illinois is that American reporters in Iraq are actually using Iraqi runners and reporters to do their basic reporting for them.
Well, that's right. I mean, there's a lot of talk right now about Cindy Sheehan, and she has this Camp Casey for her son, Casey Sheehan, who was killed on April 4th, 2004 in Sadr City in a terribly stupid military maneuver by the Bush administration. They took this guy, this Shiite cleric with a tremendous following, and they closed his newspaper. They arrested his chief advisor, and they said they were going to arrest him just because he had published an article in his newspaper titled "Bremer Follows in the Footsteps of Saddam." This was unacceptable, and so the U.S. Army, including Casey Sheehan, was sent in. And as an unembedded journalist, I was mostly interested in what effect this would have on the Iraqi people. So I got in a car with a translator friend, an engineer, and we weaved our way around the American tanks, and we made our way to the hospital. In the hospital, there was only one other journalist in the hospital interviewing people, and he was a CNN cameraman, but he was an Iraqi cameraman. He was not involved at all in the news decision-making process, so God knows what CNN did with his footage, because we interviewed a 15-year-old boy who had been shot in the vestibule of his apartment building by an American soldier as part of this attack. And he said, I don't know what I could say to the Americans. It's just up to God what happens with them. I have no idea if this is something that was used by CNN. And this is the interesting thing, right? Because you have Iraqis going out there getting footage about what's interesting to them, but then they have to go back and they have to deal with the whole CNN system.
Are average Iraqis getting American news coverage? I mean, are they seeing what we see?
Well, there's satellite television in Iraq, and most people have it because this is how you get Al Jazeera or Al Arabiya, which are the main channels that people are watching. There's also Al Hurra, which means the Freedom, which is the U.S. government-funded satellite television station broadcasting out of Virginia. It's less popular. But people get CNN, they get BBC, but I don't think people are really watching it. People are watching Jazeera if they are of a more nationalist bent, and if they're kind of more main, more secular, or less nationalistic, more pro-American, they may be watching Arabiya, which is a little bit more like CNN than Jazeera. They're seeing totally different pictures than you are here. When the United States military attacked Fallujah, we killed so many people that the municipal football stadium of Fallujah had to be turned into a graveyard for the dead. And the football stadium turf had to be ripped up, and it had to be filled in with the bodies of those killed, women, children, and the elderly, primarily the elderly, because the elderly are the least mobile and the least likely to be able to get out of the way of an American assault. So you didn't see that here in this country. This is one of the most depressing things, having just been to that football stadium, having seen that, having interviewed a 12-year-old boy who told me his 11-year-old best friend was gunned down in front of his school, to come back to this country and find people were so ignorant about that. I felt, well, I have to write a book because I have to keep disseminating the information I've already reported. I can't move on to the next story because this story has not adequately been understood yet. But in Iraq, everyone's glued to their TV watching this, and it was a important moment. You know, the book is How America Lost Iraq. This is the moment, I think, when America lost Iraq, because people were sitting at home, they were watching these images, they knew it was going on. Their relatives were telling them the same thing, and they were just, okay, enough is enough. Let's get these people out.
So what was daily life like for you when you were in Iraq?
We were living in, myself and two other journalists, we were living in a building called the Beit al-Dulaymi. It's owned by the Dulaymi family, which is a very big, important family in Fallujah. So I always thought, well, these people are the resistance, so it's probably a pretty safe place to live. They're not going to blow up their own building. It's a furnished apartment building. It looked like it was out of a 1970s blaxploitation flick. We had black backlighting and tiled kitchen, black tile kitchen, blue fan with a fake ivy wrapped around the fan. And this building, before the war, it was a honeymoon destination. So people get married, right? And then their families would guide them over to this building, and they would go up to the honeymoon suite, which was above where we were staying. We were staying on the fifth floor, and there were nicer units above. And every night there would be another wedding party that would come through. In the early days, you know, there's no electricity. This is annoying. Especially when it's 125 degrees and you don't have a fan, you can get grouchy. I mean, Baghdad is a city, it's 6 million people, it's spread out, a lot like LA, it's hot, distances are far. Imagine LA, where people don't have air conditioning and there's not a single reliably working traffic light. I mean, people get mad, they start shooting at each other, and that's what happened in Iraq. So, means that you spend a lot of time stuck in traffic in Iraq, if you're a reporter, because you have to go to lots of different locations. And some days I would just be like, oh my God, I am not going out in that traffic. I'm just going to stay home and make phone calls. You know, and I made a major effort to talk to different sections of society, to go to different neighborhoods that are richer and poorer, to go to fundamentalist political movements and secular political movements, to spend time in northern Iraq. I was in northern Iraq, different parts of northern Iraq, in Baghdad and Fallujah and Najaf. in Babylon, in Kudiala, lots of different places. And you know, the main way I would do this is I would find somebody that I knew who's from a particular place, and I would say, let's go. So I went to Diyala. Diyala's in the heart of the Sunni Triangle. I went there right in the middle of the attack on Fallujah, so Diyala was on fire. But I went to the uncle of a friend of mine's house. He happened to be a general in the old Iraqi army, and he was negotiating, trying to negotiate a ceasefire with the Americans. And I went with his nephew, and so, you know, I showed up, and they said, oh, you know, my nephew so-and-so, and oh, who is your friend? Respect. Respect is a basic issue in life. And, you know, it's amazing how much these kindergarten rules kind of play out in the real world.
So you were really able to get relatively far simply by being nice and respectful to the people that you're talking to and dealing with every day.
I mean, people understand the idea of journalism. Right. They understand that they want their story told. Mm-hmm. So, but the problem is, well, let me just say, in the fight against Muqtada Sadr, one day I was like, okay, I have to go to Sadr office and interview people in the Sadr office. So I show up at the Sadr office in an old beat-up purple van with somebody who's related distantly to Muqtada Sadr, and I interview the folks in the office about what they think about the fact that an American Apache helicopter has bombed their office the night before. I get their opinions, and then I go and I interview other people. The same day, a reporter from a major U.S. newspaper went to a different Sutter office, showed up with a whole bunch of armed men to protect him, and they said, I'm so-and-so with this major newspaper. They said, no, you're not. What kind of journalist comes with all these guns? And he said, yes, I am, and they kidnapped him. And they said, we'll let you go once we figure out that you're a journalist, and they did eventually a few hours later.
Because
they
were worried that he might be there as an agent or something.
Yeah. So, I mean, he shows up in this GMC Suburban. It's really funny, actually, in Iraq. You want to know how is it that the resistance knows who are the contractors, right? Mm-hmm. It's very easy. They're all driving white GMC Suburbans. Right. I mean, outside of the Palestine Hotel in central Baghdad, you have a parking lot. It's just full of white GMC Suburbans. And wherever you see them, that's the occupation.
Right.
That's the target. And a lot of these mainstream journalists are also traveling in, you know, bulletproof SUVs. And I don't know why they don't understand that it's much safer to be in a regular car than it is to be in a bulletproof SUV that somebody's going to try to blow up because they affiliate you with an unpopular foreign military presence. And so then the American journalists, other foreign journalists, are sitting in their hotel. I mean, there's a point at which I wouldn't watch CNN in Iraq because it was just completely useless from my perspective. So I would watch Jazeera in Arabia and sometimes the BBC. And there was a certain point. I mean, you live in Iraq. You know what it looks like when they're doing the stand-up from the Palestine Hotel and they don't go anywhere else. You're like, that's Ferdows Square. That's the view from this side of the Palestine Hotel. That's the view from that side of the Palestine Hotel. This woman did not leave the Palestine Hotel. And there's a certain point when the situation started to get unsafe. The BBC, at least, they never left the Palestine Hotel. Now, how are you supposed to explain what's going on in Iraq if all you do is take the U.S. military's word for it? You know, so they would say, we have new information, breaking news today. Brigadier General Mark Kimmett, the spokesperson for the Coalition Provisional Authority, says blah, blah, blah. And I said, that cannot possibly be true. I was there. I mean, I was in Sadr City. I was in Fallujah. I saw what's happening. And that's a lie. I mean, I can say, and it was just infuriating. I started to yell at the television because it's one thing to be sitting here in America and have a vague sense that what you're getting is not completely the truth. It's another thing to see what the U.S. military is actually doing with your own eyes, come back to your apartment, turn on the TV, and have somebody who's broadcasting to the entire world say something completely different.
And as Aaron Glantz, a reporter for Free Speech Radio News and Pacifica, he's recently authored a book called How America Lost Iraq on Penguin Books. That brings to a close another edition of Media Geek. I'll be back in 1 week with more news of our media environment. In the meantime, check out Media Geek online at www.mediageek.org. There you'll find the Media Geek blog, with frequently updated news and views on independent media. You'll also find archive editions of the program in MP3 and the open-source Ogg Vorbis format. You can also subscribe to the podcast to have the program automatically downloaded to your computer or MP3 player. The closing music is Fire in the Sky by Adam Luo. Media Geek is produced live at Community Radio WEFT in Champaign, Illinois. Portions of the program are pre-recorded at Media Geek Studios. Media Geek is also aired on community radio stations KQRP in Salida, California, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KRBS in Oroville, California, WSLR in Sarasota, Florida, and WTND in Macomb, Illinois. And Media Geek is free to air on your local, non-commercial, or community radio station, too. Just email Paul at mediageek.org. You can use that email address to send comments, too. I'm always interested to know what you think of the show. Again, that's Paul at mediageek.org. Thanks for tuning in.